Periscope globally, and as especially right now in Turkey, where it is 1900 hours. This is the first of what I hope are many, where a group of colleagues get together to have a discussion about a pressing issue of the day, drawing upon their special informed knowledge. Turkey is approaching an election on November 1st, and the title of our discussions is Intensifying Crisis in Turkey, and we hope that for those who are in Turkey, we present some alternative perspectives from afar. For those who are interested in Turkey from a distance, we hope that we can inform, give you perspectives that are not readily available, and particularly as our colleagues explore common and competing or different perspectives. We will Ertug Tombaş will actually start our discussion by providing a framework, some ground out, some groundwork, some basic facts about the situation right now, and then as it seems most comfortable, Banu Bargu and Andrew Arado will follow with their opening comments. The idea is that these comments will be relatively short, and then they and then all of us will have ongoing conversation. Just a word about our participants. They're well known to me, but maybe not to everyone in this room and out in Periscope land. Ertug Tombaş has a PhD in political science from Kent University in Ankara, Turkey. He's presently an adjunct assistant professor at West Connecticut State University, and is the managing editor of the journal Constellations, and is working currently on his dissertation in sociology at the New School for Social Research. Banu Bargu is my colleague, associate professor, associate professor in politics at the New School for Social Research. Her main specialization is political theory, especially modern and contemporary political thought, with thematic concentration on issues of sovereignty, resistance, and biopolitics. Her most recent book is Starve and Emulation, and Emulate, which I understand is actually a prize-winning book. I don't remember where the prizes come from.
American Political Science Association.
Well deserved. And the person on my immediate right is my longtime friend and colleague, Andrew Arado, Dorothy Hart Hershon Professor of Political and Social Theory. He works on a wide range of topics. I like to think that I am, I have only one expertise, and that is that I'm an expert in the opposition to a system that no longer exists in East Central Europe, and we share that expertise. But as well, Andrew has done extraordinarily important work on the questions of constitutions and politics, and has applied that general expertise to the case of Turkey with telling insight, exciting, sharp controversies. I don't think that the controversies are going to be that sharp in our discussions today, but we will explore them in a kind of open and creative fashion, I hope. So, please start.
Yeah, thank you.
The director is saying, wait a minute.
Yeah, they're complaining about the noise I'm trying to.
Okay. Thank you. So I will start with briefly pointing out certain.
You want me to stop?
Facts or events.
Okay.
They,
stop for just a
saying
second.
They can't hear and they want to hear, so I have to fix it. I'm sorry.
Is it the back? Is it the white
noise?
Yeah. Maybe use that microphone.
Yeah.
Does that help?
At least the opening statements.
We can go over there.
You want to request one
is
of the
hand. Voice better? Is the voice better?
He's soft spoken, the two of us.
We no, is the voice better?
Now's the time to leave.
Yes? It's working?
Sorry.
Thank you.
So, as I said, I will start very briefly and try to mention some critical events that have been, that happened since June 7 election. So I'll start with the election. And then I will briefly point out my take on the intensifying crisis, leaving the rest of the argument I'm trying to develop to the discussion. So June 7th general election ended with the AKP's, the Justice and Development Party, AKP's loss or defeat by losing almost 9% of the vote and getting 40% of vote. Here, as you see, still AKP is the largest party in the parliament, yet lost a simple majority in the parliament to needed to form a single party government. And that is important given the fact that the AKP enjoyed a simple majority since 2002 for 13 years forming single party governments. So if you will look the results, let me share with you the numbers, not all of them, but the two significant, of course, the AKP getting 40% of the vote, 40.9, losing almost 9%, HDP, People's Democratic Party, almost double, even more than double, the previous vote they get from 6 to 13.1. So, as we can see, without any party, without having a simple majority, the result requires the formation of a coalition government or a minority government. The Constitution requires the parliament to form the Council of Ministers within 45 days. At the end of 45 days, the President can, or may, with very important distinction, of course, may renew the elections. And what happened is that the 45 days exhausted, no party can, the AKP couldn't form the Council of Ministers, the government, and then President Erdogan declared renewed the elections, so renewed the elections. And meanwhile, in July 20, a suicide bombing killed 33 people in Sooch, a city of Urfa near the Syrian border. A delegation of the Federation of Socialist Youth Association planned to go to Kobane to help with the restoration of the city. They couldn't go because the authorities didn't allow them to cross the borders. During this press statement in Truj, a suicide bombing killed 33 of them. 2 days later, two police officers found shot dead in Ceylanpınar, another city in Urfa, around 100 miles away from Truj. And in a statement by the People's Defense Forces, HPG, the military arm of the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, said, and I quote, a punitive action was carried out in revenge for the massacre in Sooch. Later, the PKK denied the murders. Still, there's a mystery about the murders of these police officers. But later Erdogan, the President Erdogan and the Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu used the massacre and the murder of two police to wage war on PKK, interestingly enough, not on ISIS, who's responsible from the bombings and so on. And the intensified violence is not only limited with air strikes against PKK, while the Kurdish cities and towns have been under attack, curfews declared, civilian deaths were reported, and intensified police violence. And I will give some numbers and explanations from Human Rights Association report from the region to be more accurate. So in Cizre, one of the Kurdish populated cities of 130,000 population, continuous curfew declared for 9 days, causing the citizens to leave deprived of their basic needs during the curfew. Water and power cut went on, trash piles, citizens could not get medical treatment, deprived of accessing basic health services. People cannot bury the funerals, so that they are obliged to keep them in refrigerators at home or at their offices or homes, using ice-filled plastic bottles to keep the funerals cold. The bans and policy of curfew was started with the claim of security needs of citizens, and now became punishment practices by which the citizens could not cover the basic, their basic needs. Meanwhile, the media and internet ban has been reinforced, leading to progressive silencing of free and independent media. Court orders have been issued, blocking websites and Twitter accounts on ground that they have been promoting terrorist propaganda. HDP, the People's Democratic Party offices, were attacked by mobs that the police did not do anything about. Newspaper offices and journalists were attacked as well. According to some the numbers that the Human Rights Association shared, during July and August, almost a month period of time, 2,686 people, including 127 children and 5 foreign nationals, have been arrested. Of these, 160 people were allegedly affiliated to ISIS, 22 to the parallel structure that they call it, or the Gulen movement, and the others were members of the KJK or PKK and other leftist groups. 352 people have been detained. It has been documented by the Human Rights Association that in 213 cases, people have been abused while in detention. Again, according to the Human Rights Association, 132 people, including 12 children, would have been seriously wounded during demonstrations that took place across the country. Almost all of the detainees were exposed to torture and maltreatment. 48 civilians dead, 6 children, 93 soldier police were dead, 6 village guards, 57 HPD militants were dead. And meanwhile, there are attempts of lynch in many cities against the Kurdish citizens, HDP offices, or members. This followed by one of the horrible twin suicide bombings in Ankara. So during the Labour, Democracy and Peace rally, with the participation of Confederation of Public Worker Union, Confederation of Progressive Trade Unions of Turkey, Turkish Medical Association, and Union of Chambers of Turkish Engineers and Architects, numerous NGOs, civil society organizations, political parties, and citizens, 2 suicide bombs detonated 2 bombs. And not only the severity or the horrible consequences and loss of lives of the bombings, but the negligence by the states in not only in preventing the bombings, but also afterwards was severely criticized. Again, in line with the quote from the Human Rights Association's report, the right to life and the right to peaceful assembly were severely violated during the Ankara Labour, Democracy and Peace rally in October 10, 2015. According to European Court of Human Rights, states have 2 kinds of obligations, namely negative and positive obligations. The negative obligation of the state is to refrain from violating rights. Its positive obligation is to take measures and protect the people. The state has failed to perform its obligations to prevent grave violations of the right to life, even if the blasts leading to the death of more than 100 people were not caused by public officials, the military or the police, or persons affiliated to the security and intelligence units of the state. The state, nevertheless, has a positive obligation to meet and failed to adopt the intelligence measures that it should have adopted. The negligence is so severe in those cases that even claiming that somehow or at some power the state officials or the intelligence services part of or at least deliberately neglect the informations causing the bombings would not be a conspiracy theory. Similar violations occurred during the public meeting in Diyarbakir, at which HDP President Selahattin Demirtaş planned to give a speech. And then in Suruç, same kind of negligence were reported as well. So the attitude of the state in these events, where dozens of people were killed, was similar to its attitude towards October 10th massacre. The attitude of the state is unacceptable with regard to the right to life, as the Human Rights Association declared. So at the end of the before June 7 election, so we should put, of course, that it is not like before June 7 election everything was good, there's no problem in Turkey. During the campaign period, we see the indications that the AKP will react in this way for a possible loss of election. Especially in the speeches of Erdogan, we saw his turn to register PKK and the Kurdish movement, claims from the political party HDP directly to terrorism. So they used different words, different symbols in order to delegitimize HDP when it's possible electoral success. But in June 7, and afterwards, the change was so drastic that the country find itself into a horrible situation, facing a very deep split, not only political but also social level. So I can continue with my comments, but or I can.
Actually, maybe it would be good if Andrew speaks now, and then maybe you can speak then after Bob. Yeah. Yes, please.
Okay. Of course, my presentation will be inevitably more general because I don't have the kind of detailed knowledge of Turkey by far as Banu and Ertug have. Also because I've been looking at Turkey more or less with the interest of comparisons rather than just an interest in Turkey itself, which I have, but it is that interest is structured by my work on other places. Roughly the same time, Jeffrey mentioned this, our area, common area of expertise, roughly the same time as in Central Europe, a process of democratization was launched in Turkey too. This already happens under the prime ministership of Turgut Özal, but it really takes off in the mid-1990s. I think it'd be incorrect to say, as Sheila Ben Habib and Türkül Ayizeksel argue someplace, that Turkey too had its revolution, using this term of the mythic art and ash, because whatever happened in Turkey, whatever took place in Turkey, is certainly an incomplete project. It is only a series of moves that were involved. But at least in terms of teleology and in terms of Turkey's location in Europe, there is the element that was shared with the Central European countries, namely the desire of many political actors to democratize a system which was certainly quite authoritarian in its 1982 or 3 beginnings. Two aspects of this in Turkey left a lot to be desired. One was the already mentioned extreme gradualism, which really is more like a Mexican or Chilean development than it is a Central European one. And secondly, the fact that it was a reform process, primarily top-down nature, even if there were consultations and negotiations, especially in the 1990s, but early 2000s too, among political factors. Had the thing been also bottom-up, it would have been much more early realized that in Turkey the problem was not only democratization in the sense of changing the constitution to a more democratic one, but also state transformation. Because the state that was created also by top-down revolution from above means in the 1930s was one that was perceived as discriminatory and exclusionary, at least by two large groups in Turkish society, the religious and the Kurdish minority, other minorities too. But the Kurds were the largest in number in that sense. It was their complaints and their criticism that should have counted the most. I don't see any Kurdish role, for example, interestingly enough, and I haven't even asked myself this question until this very moment, I don't see any Kurdish role in the negotiating processes of the 1990s or early 2000s. Obviously, there are Kurdish people there, all political parties in Turkey have people who are descendants or who are ethnically part of the Kurdish community, but there was no Kurdish political role. Roughly the same time as this is happening, the kind of exclusion that was perceived by Kurds led to not just mobilization, but also to a revolutionary movement that organized itself initially, at least on Marxist-Leninist lines. And also, on the other side, the repeated mobilization of the religious in Islamic parties, that several of them have been declared unconstitutional and suspended, but were always reformed, and seemed to become more and more powerful with time. So the task in the 2000s became a double task, to democratize the political institutions and to transform the structure of the state. As we know from comparative experience, the only way to solve that problem is through negotiation, certainly not majority rule, which in the case of the religious may have actually achieved many of their goals, but certainly in terms of the ethnic national problem, majority rule could not be a solution to the conflicts. And so yesterday I had a debate with Mahmoud Mamdani, who is very critical of the South African process. I don't know how many of you were there. I think of it much more positively. I think a South African process would have been extremely helpful in Turkey, a South African-type process in the 2000s, involving comprehensive negotiations and coming to what he derisively described as the second best. I think the second best is by far great.
Fantastic.
But he thought these things only lead to the second best from anybody's point of view, which is good, because if anybody gets their best, then someone else gets their worst. So this second best was attainable. And we know it's attainable because Mr. Erdogan himself began a process, a settlement process, where he conceded very little, but one actually saw the incredible willingness on the Kurdish side to participate. I think even HDP's strength in Turkey emerged from the fact that there was such a process and there was a certain amount of optimism within the Kurdish community to work within the political structure. Now, why this was not done, there are a lot of reasons why such a process of comprehensive negotiations where all sides would have made compromises was not done. But at least one factor was, and you can perceive it from 2007 on, probably the seeds of it were there earlier, in the welfare party from which the prime minister, then prime minister, came from. From 2007 on, I could see a drive toward a monolithic solution that would be driven simply by the interest and, in all those cases, there to said, the votes of the majority. There was even a moment when these goals could have been compromised. So Erdogan and I wrote a joint piece where we entertained the possibility of some kind of arrangement around the majoritarian goal, which we already said was presidentialism back then. One could see it in 2007 already, the seeds of that, and the interest of the Kurdish community, because in a way, some kind of presidential, semi-presidential system was compatible with devolution of authority, with provincial autonomies and so on. The first best from the point of view of an alternative figure like Erdogan, but it could have very much been his second best to get most of his own, to realize most of his goals and to concede something to the Kurds. Now, in our own period, we see that that solution from the point of view of the leading group in the AKP no longer an acceptable one. Any kind of second best option when you have that kind of majority and you and the 2011 elections were 2011 elections, not in terms of seats but in terms of votes, they received the largest number of votes that they ever had. The idea certainly was that that some kind of imposed solution, if one only could get to the relevant parlamentary figures, would be possible, and supported also in the international context of the time. The 2007 elections threw a monkey wrench into this project. Not only did the number of votes now drop, said 9%, something like this, by 9%, but the number of seats dropped beyond the 3/5 figures. The newspapers always say 2/3, American newspapers, but the actual figure you need with a referendum is 3/5 to enact your own constitution. They have dropped, well, they were beyond, they were under that figure slightly before 2011, but dropped well beyond it, behind it. Indeed, they dropped under even a simple majority in 2015. So at this point, the question was, is there going to be a retreat or is there going to be a move forward? Probably the corruption conflict, the conflict over Gezi, made such a retreat no longer plausible. In any case, what we know is that, and this is, finishing in about 2 seconds, 2 minutes, the moves of the Turkish government from the 2007 on have been quite unbelievable. Ertuğ reflected on it from the point of view of the human costs and the violence that has been involved, which is considerable. But think about other aspects of this. Coalition negotiations are sabotaged. That's a significant thing in a country which where there's no minority, no majority government that can be formed. So of course you can have another election, and if that election doesn't work, you can have another election. And you can continue to have elections keeping in power a provisional government which the president supports. This in a way resembles the Weimar scenario, where extraordinary provisions of the constitution are used to maintain or to develop an authoritarian form. So coalition negotiations are sabotaged. The remnants of a peace process, which were already quite weak at the time, are abandoned. And to me, I mean, this even the press in Turkey, even the critical press, is afraid to, I think, for legal reasons, to say so. As far as I can see, the new conflict was directly initiated by the Turkish government and not by the PKK, which has responded to some acts of violence, but which itself did not start the process of opening up open warfare. So a war is created. That's the second major aspect, and then all the things that all of you know: the attack on the press, the arrests of individuals who have played any kind of critical role, the innuendo that one way or the other, unless the majority is reelected, or majority is the previous majority is reelected, there will be no peace in Turkey. Violent acts like the attack in Ankara, but also previous one in Diyarbakir. These are all parts of a scenario which attempt to substitute for a political process, a militarized process of conflict resolution. The big question I will leave you with this: can such a thing work in a country as complex as Turkey, with as high level of education in much of society, with institutions that remain in some sense still independent, with a political party in power which has to also think about its future role as a political party, with a military that has been certainly domesticated but which is still there as an independent force? Can such a thing actually work? And I would imagine the next step, if the election is lost, would be try to somehow cheat on the elections. I mean, once you are cornered in the way that Erdogan is, and the system of electoral accounting is in your hands, the temptation to cheat would be great. What would happen then? And is it possible to get away with that step too? And if, on the other hand, they don't cheat, and the next election on Sunday is also lost, then the question is, what happens then? Because I already seen the press hints that Erdogan actually wouldn't mind a third election. In other words, to continue the process of having elections but not having elected governments. And I think the great question for all of you is whether it's possible to get away with that in Turkey and in Europe, which plays, at least at the moment, a modest role in the process, but which could play a greater role. I don't know the answer to that, because there is a trend in the whole region toward authoritarian government, and it's possible to get away with it in the sense that Putin has gotten away with it, in the sense that Orban is getting away with it in my home country, and so perhaps Erdogan can get away with it. But most of them, Putin has used war for this purpose, but most of the others who are moving in this direction have not actually opened up the war, which, let's look at it from the point of view of military, and I'll stop with this, even from the point of view of military, which has been certainly interested in cracking down on the Kurds historically, the idea of reopening this particular war, which means no real victories, there's never any victory in it, and it means continual losses of personnel, can't be all that attractive.
And at a time of geopolitical vulnerability.
Not to speak of the vulnerability caused by the policy in Syria,
right,
where it's directly against the interest of the United States, which is de facto an ally of the YPG. In fact, I think it is, in Iraq it's an ally of the Kurdistan Regional Government, but in Syria it's the ally of the, indirectly also of the PKK then. So the geopolitical aspect of it is also a limit, although the Americans have been pretty permissive so far. But I think as they run out of strategies in Syria, they may not be. All right, next step.
Hello, well, with Artu's and Andrew's opening remarks, but I will take a slightly different track and focus on the experience of violence in the recent context. So the election of June 7 was a watershed moment, not only in terms of HDP's electoral success, practically eliminating an anti-democratic electoral threshold of 10%, one of the highest around the world, that was put into place under military rule after the 1980 coup d'etat. It was also the loss of AKP's simple majority as a result of HDP's electoral success, which put an end to its overrepresentation in parliament thanks to the same electoral threshold. Meanwhile, the peace process that was already stagnant prior to the elections broke down completely, marking a speedy devolution into armed conflict within Turkey's borders and airstrikes over northern Iraq and Syria as part of the U.S.-led coalition against Islamic State, but also semi-autonomously from it, insofar as the target has been the Kurdish forces. With the death toll of soldiers, policemen, PKK combatants, and civilians already in the several hundreds. At the same time, Turkey became the target of suicide attacks carried out by Islamic State militants, first in Suruç and more recently in Ankara, killing first 32 socialists and then 102 demonstrators participating in a peace rally. Now, with the escalation of armed conflict inside Turkey, the securitization of public discourse and the militarization and polarization among the civilian population have also escalated and with great speed. Entire cities have been locked down, special operations forces and snipers have surfaced, temporary security zones have been declared, reviving the specter of state of emergency rule that remained in force for over a decade in the eastern and southeastern provinces, even after military rule had formally ended in 1983. The current interim government has been subjected to fierce criticism for instrumentalizing the conflict as a way to buttress AKP's electoral base on nationalistic grounds, rather than working to reactivate the peace process, as well as Artur has already mentioned, being negligent in taking the necessary precautions for the protection of citizens against the violence of Islamic State. Now, in addressing the aftermath of the election, I want to focus my remarks on the experience of armed conflict, especially one incident of violence perpetrated by the state's security forces. I consider this incident worthy of consideration for its wide-reaching implications. On August 15, 2015, the image of a naked and bloody corpse of a woman was leaked to the press. The body lay face down next to a cardboard covered with plastic, a makeshift stretcher with which she was carried, and in front of the three men photographed below the shoulders, all wearing civilian clothes, and one with a pair of blue vinyl gloves standing around it. The body in the images belonged to Kevser Ertürk, also known as Ekin Van, a PKK militant and fighter who had allegedly died some days earlier on August 10th in a confrontation with the security forces in the rural district of Bartok, tied to the city of Muş. As the image of the woman's dead body lying naked on the street went viral on social media, it drew celebratory, derogatory, and vitriolic ultranationalist commentary, furious reactions, and much indignation from human rights and women's organizations. The governor of Muş issued a statement that said, and I quote, "It has come to our attention that some images of a female member of the PKK terrorist organization who was killed in a clash with our security forces in the rural area of the Varto district of our province on August 10, 2015, are being circulated on some social media networks. Administrative and criminal investigations were launched against those who shared those images in this way that is unacceptable to the public or the governor's office." End of quote. As it is clear from the statement, what was unacceptable to the governor's office and the object of the investigation was not the stripping naked of the Kurdish woman's body, nor its photography, but the distribution of the images and their circulation. In response to this dishonorable display of the dead body, Kurdish women took to the streets in various different provinces on August 19th with posters that read, and I quote, "Ekin Van is the naked form of our resistance. Ekin Van is our honor, and it is dishonorable to play with the people's honor through its body." An evocative slogan read, "When the state undresses or prepares itself for torture, women dress or put on the dress of the resistance." Prominent Kurdish women's organizations condemned the violence in stark terms. On August 23rd, a Kurdish woman carried out a protest in front of a parliamentary building in Stockholm, taking off her clothes and lying face down on the ground with red paint over her body, reenacting the scene that was disseminated in the image. Peace activists in Ankara and Istanbul also staged demonstrations. Members of parliament from HDP, such as Leyla Zana, filed a parliamentary motion that asked for a written explanation from the Minister of Interior about what happened, posing questions regarding the incident. In this motion, she suggested that it was not clear whether the woman was killed in a clash or captured alive and killed under torture. Asking for official clarification, she mentioned that the ligature marks on the body showed not only evidence of torture, but also that she was dragged in the streets. So, in my opinion, this incident offers a very important occasion to analyze various kinds of violence employed by the state in Turkey today. Here, I would like to draw attention to three registers of this violence. First, the lawlessness. What is striking in this incident is not the reference to PKK's terrorism, as one can glean from the governor's office statement, as the justification of state killing. What is striking is how quickly Turkey was able to slide back into the non-exceptionality of the exception. With this expression, I want to make both a temporal argument, namely that there's a significant continuity of this exceptional incident with the historically violent practices of the state, and a scope argument, namely that however outrageous, this is not an isolated incident, but must be situated within an almost systematic economy of violence that is played out, at least in part, over dead bodies. Let me explain what I mean by both. By pointing to a certain continuity between the present and the past, I want us to consider this incident as part of the long durée of the Turkish state's deployment of extra-legal violence on its citizens. One need not go back to the early Republican period here, though many examples can be found there. But it should be sufficient to consider the rampant torture within military prisons during the early 1980s, the enforced disappearances, the extrajudicial killings, the mutilation of dead bodies, and the dirty war of the 1990s, more recently Operation Return to Life of the year 2000, the security operation into some 20 prisons in order to quash the hunger strike of political prisoners and to transfer them into super maximum security prisons, as well as the targeted police violence displayed upon unarmed crowds during the occupation of Gezi Park. So when some commentators today draw attention that we are returning to the 90s, it is important to be mindful of the serious and ongoing state tradition of violence in Turkey, or tradition of state violence in Turkey, which has had its ebbs and flows but has never completely disappeared. On the other hand, by pointing to the systematicity of violence upon the dead, I want to situate this incident in a broader context that includes other forms of violence upon the dead, such as delaying the entry of dead bodies of the fighters who have lost their lives in Rojava as part of the struggle against Islamic State back into Turkey for burial by their families and holding them up at the border in a truck for days. The bombing of cemeteries and shrines built to honor guerrilla fighters, the attacks on and repression of funeral processions, as well as the mutilation and dismemberment of insurgent bodies. The sheer variety of these tactics and their repetition should at least alarm us about how exceptional this one incident is. The second register I want to underscore is the sexualized nature of this violence. In reading this event, it is impossible to overlook the patriarchy that has thoroughly infused it. The targeting of the woman's body and the allegations of rape have rightly provoked feminists to condemn the attack as femicide. But the key point, in my opinion, is the instrumentalization of the woman's body, its denuding and dishonoring, as the means by which the humiliation of a people is enacted. It is the interweaving of feminization and inferiorization, not just death and racism. This, of course, rests on a prior and implicit equivalence between the woman's chastity and modesty with the honor and chastity of a nation. Thus, once that chastity is violated, the expectation is that an entire people embodied in that chastity will be dishonored. Inversely, we can interpret the same instrumentalization of the body as the indirect way of indicating what it is to be a proper female citizen. In the violent and possibly violated display of the corpse of a woman whose life choice as a fighter defies the conventional norms of being a woman, a mother, a wife, or daughter of a soldier, or a dutiful subject of the law, what is being affirmed and reproduced is precisely those norms of obedience, submissiveness, and the engendering through the body of a woman of the unity of the nation. According to Nazan Üstündağ, for example, such violence over the woman's dead body reveals the state's desire to punish by going even further than death, while also inscribing itself into the realm of this, of the most intimate relationships. So, a third register of this violence concerns its psychic implications, embedded as this act is within a practice of psychological warfare that is a crucial component of counterinsurgency techniques. In this war, dead bodies are just as much part of the struggle as live ones. Hishyar Özsoy tells in his terrific dissertation on the politics of the dead that dead bodies are transformed into the symbolic and material vehicles of subduing the insurgent population. The desecration of the dead becomes a new site of articulating national identity, of producing the ethnic, spiritual supremacy of the Turkish nation. It aims to disable the power of the dead, make the deaths go to waste. I borrow this expression from Özsoy, who argues preventing the reappropriation into the symbolic economy of the living is an important tactic. The spectacularity of violence, its display in the town square, as it were, not only reveals a vindictive state that requires the world to see the proof that it can restore its sovereignty wounded by insurgents. The production of the remains of violence in spectacular and mediatized form also exacerbates the dehumanization and demoralization of the enemy. There is a forcing into visibility, and I borrow this term from Artu, it suggested to me on an earlier occasion, of how an insurgent body will be punished and how the proper body must be constituted in stark opposition to it. The dissemination and circulation of the images of desecration reproduce the symbolic violence of the event in the everyday, further militarizing and polarizing the public sphere. Meanwhile, violence to the dead enacts, or at least aims to enact, a forceful desubjectification of the enemy by transforming it into an object, a thing that is nonetheless vulnerable to violence and violation. At the same time, it's important to note how this dead body also becomes the object of resignification and reappropriation, especially through counter-discourses of martyrdom and struggle, of mobilization and uprising. It might be helpful to recall the widespread protests of the 1990s around funerals here. So these three different registers of state violence are all at work in the event of Atatürk's naked dead body, which was put on display as a public spectacle, that is, at the same time, a performance of the state through its necropolitics. Commentators who have written on this particular event or similar ones have frequently resorted to Judith Butler's powerful work to interpret the politics over dead bodies. Butler eloquently asks the question of what lives are grievable as the index of what lives are worthy of protection and value. It is true that the torture and exhibition of dead bodies make the work of mourning much more difficult, effectively policing the affective boundaries of who belongs to the nation and who doesn't, by rendering some bodies ungrievable or ungrievable to one part of the population. This, of course, presupposes the prior condition of having already decided that certain bodies are unacceptable for the nation, insurgent, treasonous, and hence not worthy to live. One cannot but think of Foucault's definition of racism here. However evocative, I'm not sure that this is the most adequate framing for reading this particular event. This is because while the state's violence attempts to render these bodies ungrievable, at least for the Turkish people, it also renders mourning itself into a tool of government. Let us recall the declaration of a day of national mourning after the passing of King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, but not for the 32 socialists who were killed by a suicide attack in Suruç this past summer. By contrast, for the population in the midst of conflict, we observe the suspension of mourning and the acceptance, perhaps even glorification of death through the discourse of heroism and martyrdom. Perhaps the question that is more urgent to ask right now, and this is what I want to leave us with, is not whether we can grieve this death, whether we can share the grief in common, but whether we can share a sense of anger at the blatant disregard of human life and the law, a disregard that is planned, perpetrated, and later protected by the state. I want to ask whether we can build our solidarities not on common grief, but on the common struggle against the violence of the state in the East and in the West, in order to hold it accountable for civilian harm and for war crimes. It seems to me that the political demand and the popular will to restart the peace process will be bound to remain weak if we cannot transform selective grief into common resolve, resolve into solidarity, in order to counteract the lawless symbolic violence that continually undermines and disables the desire of the two peoples to live together. The incident of Kfar Atatürk should remind us that we are at a very dangerous threshold in which the ground of a democratic Turkey in which all citizens want a common future is swiftly withering away. So I'll end here.
So, Ertug, I would ask you to add your voice,
okay.
But maybe as you're adding your voice, start the discussion among the panelists and everyone in the room.
My best. So I just want to add a couple of things, some arguments and thesis. So first of all, if you go back to June 7 elections, I think June 8 was a happy day for the people in Turkey, for the equality of the democracy, or at least the future of them. Because given the history of the military interventions, defeating a government, a party with a record of increased authoritarian measures, instrumentalization of law for the elimination of opposition, polarizing society to consolidate power through an election, defeating that party through an election, is the best option. And at least with June 7, it started. On the other hand, HDP's success, I think, is more than just simple passing the threshold. Because if we compare the programs and the election speeches between AKP and HDP, you basically see two different political language, two different political mentality. One is polarizing, exclusionary, and the other one is inclusionary, celebrating plurality in terms of not only the program and the promises they made, but also in terms of the actual composition of their candidates. And also HDP made effort to broaden its basis to many different parts of society, different identities, different issues, well beyond Kurdish issue or the Kurdish identity. And I just want to underline that this broadening is a kind of mutual process. This is on the one hand, HDP tried what they call kind of HDP becoming a party for Turkey in general. But it also it includes a development where maybe we can say that the West, if it is proper to use the East and the West tried to understand, especially since Gezi, at least even in a small amount, to understand what happened and what's going on the East. So this HDP is broadening its space. Is not only HDP encompass all these or include other identities, but all these other identities try to understand and kind of creating an empathy with the Kurdish experience, especially since during the 1990s. Although this is very small process, or a very small tendency, but still that is the tendency where you can consider as a seed that the democracy can cultivate, that should be protected instead of smashed and violently eliminated like we have been, the state has been doing it. Now, just I just want to underline that although this is a parliamentary election, I think the loser of the election is President Erdogan, because he himself, by fiercely and unconstitutionally campaigning for AKP and asking for 400 members, make this election, turn this election into a plebiscite for himself and for the presidential ambitions he has. In case AKP got 400 members or even 330, we all know with the past experiences Erdogan would have interpreted this as a mandate for presidential change. So the loss should be the denial. And I just want to underline this 400. I think it is not just any number. And by 400, I think Erdogan is not only trying to bypass the parliamentary differences or the parliamentary resistance. 330 would be enough for that. What he is trying to bypass or overcome with 400 is referendum. Because he also knows that he is trying to do something against the will of the people that he claims to represent. Why 400? Take 330, go to referendum and see what the people says. But the polls even say that even the electors of the AKP will not support that. So from this perspective, how could the election results have been evaluated? If we just assume, it's a very bold assumption, but if we assume for a minute that the Erdogan and the AKP has genuine commitment to democratic values, then the message was clear. You have almost 70%, around 70% for the peace. At least the parties around the table in the peace process, their electors did not punish them because of that. And also there is, if we consider this as a presidential a plebiscite for the president, then there is at least 60% of votes saying no. So from now on, it could be developed taking that message. But instead, Erdogan chose to wage his own dirty war in order to punish the Kurdish votes, to show what would happen if they don't vote for AKP. The political lines turned into a collective punishment in the region, targeting not the sacred reasons, certain people, that is, with the assumption of they are related to PKK or any other militants in the region, but the whole region, the people living there, the general population have been suffering. What I claim is that, or what I disagree, is that as if there is a turn in Erdogan. Let me finish with this. That some interpreters since Gezi keep saying that, look, these are originally democratic ideas and they somehow turned into an authoritarian. Some people explain this turn with the psychology of Erdogan, or some people says the power corrupts, absolute power absolutely corrupts, so with the corrupting effect of power just turn this otherwise a democratic actor into an authoritarian monster. I argue and I claim that the metamorphosis of Erdogan especially is just as showed, the experience we have in the 13 years showed. With Gezi, it showed that there is no difference between democracy or autocracy for Erdogan as long as one of them serves for the consolidation of power. And with whatever happened since June elections showed that even peace and war has no moral or political difference for Erdogan when it comes to being a political instrument to consolidate his power. It starts with a majoritarianism and swings to a populist authoritarianism, and now approaching it to fascism almost, kind of testifying for our friend Federico Finkelstein's argument that the populism is a reformulated fascism in the post-World War times. Not only the state violence, but the violence with the mobs in the streets, burning HDB offices, lynching activities, has this swing even almost towards a fascist form. Now, after the November election, so there are different, of course, possibilities. And one, I think the worst case would be, one of the worst case maybe would be a parliament without HDP. Because every poll shows that there's no distinct, there's no difference between the polls. So as we talked, we mentioned, that only can happen through electoral fraud. And even if you cannot prove that, for, especially for the Kurdish population, a party without HDP would be less legitimate. And also the message to the Kurdish people with that is that we don't allow your political existence. The only way you can do is armed conflict. So elimination of political possibility would be detrimental for the future of Turkey. Now, in terms of the same picture appears. We have four parties and the coalition is another issue. I don't think Erdogan will accept. He will retreat because losing power is not just for him being in opposition or losing the power and having a retired life and making maybe painting in Marmaris. So here, the problem for him is maybe facing trials. So this is a kind of existential problem in a way for him. So he will not retreat, that we know. Now the problem is about the party. So what I see is the 2002, the political Islam with the party AKP is a kind of combination of a movement, a party, and the leader. The Gulen movement, the AKP as the party, and Erdogan is the leader. As if, let's just think about a rocket that you launched, right? It goes and every higher and one piece goes down, and another piece goes down. So now the one piece goes down, because this eclectic combination is because of their anti-Kemalism. So when they dislocate Kemalism from power, so then Gulen movement just went down after December 13 and 25. And now you have the party and Erdogan. And it seems that the Erdogan wants a party loyal absolutely to him. Now that's AKP's decision when it comes again with four party and the coalition possibilities, whether AKP is the part will go down or the Erdogan will go down. Who will leave whom? And that is maybe a very important question. We will see the answer.